Hello and welcome to Securing Sexuality, the podcast where we discuss the intersection of intimacy
and information security. I'm Wolf Gorlick.
He's a hacker, and I'm Stephanie Gorlick.
She is a sex therapist, and together we're going to discuss what safe sex looks like in a digital age.
Today we are joined by somebody I am super excited to talk to. Ashley Winter is a board-certified urologist based in Los Angeles, and she's the director of the FemTech line at FirmTech, a company we have been hearing more and more about. As a practicing urologist, she has witnessed firsthand how the intersectionality of female urinary, genital, and hormone health was underserved by traditional medical specialties. That is definitely something I have experienced. And it is her professional mission to build technologies and healthcare platforms that increase access to sexual health. I am so excited to hear about this. Ashley, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on. I love your mission. That's very, very cool to be a hacker and a sex therapist working together. I love it.
And your world brings our worlds together.
Yes.
You work for a company that builds technology and devices that are used in some sexual ways and sexual circumstances, but promote and focus on sexual health. Tell us more about what that looks like.
Yeah, sure. So the company is called FirmTech, as you mentioned. Their website is MyFirmTech, if you're looking for it, MyFirmTech.com. And the primary product cohort that's on the market now is the penis-focused device, which, of course, right, the penis is always the first. Unfortunately, I think in innovation development, when it comes to sexuality, unfortunately, people, put the penis always happens to come first, but that's neither here nor there. And what our primary product is essentially a smart cock ring, which I know that is like, what? And basically it's a cock ring that has pressure sensor in it. So, and it connects via Bluetooth to an app and can essentially measure the duration and the rigidity of your erection, which is pretty awesome. But my role, primary role in the company is that we are developing a female line. And so the clitoris having people line, and that focus is to generate wearable devices that provide quantitative data on female sexual or clitoral sexual function. And so we have prototypes. We've completed already research studies with very exciting results. And the idea is to make, a first in its kind wearable consumer product that gives insight into how the clitoris and the genitals are aroused. It's thrilling. It's thrilling stuff. I mean, it basically, the really quick way to explain it would be, your clitoris Fitbit. Not exactly, but that's the concept behind it. So.
So you mentioned research. What were you surprised to find in that research?
I wouldn't say it's that the results were surprising, but more so thrilling that they were that it was able to show what we know in best case the device could do. So what do I mean by that, right? So traditionally when we're studying clitoral responsiveness or female sexual arousal, we use, questionnaires or subjective measures, right? Like, were you lubricated? Were you aroused? How aroused were you on a scale from 1 to 5? Things that aren't able to actually measure that, right? It's just a kind of a subjective reporting. So, the analogy would be like, instead of actually doing an EKG on you to measure your heart rate and your waveform, somebody just asked you, did you feel like your heart was racing? You have a sense, but there's not a lot of granularity to how you're able to subjectively report on what your heart rate was doing, right? So the same is how we've traditionally relied on our ability to document and understand, you know, the way the clitoris and the surrounding genitalia respond to sexual stimuli. So, so the issue is, right, is capturing this. Like, how do you get a sensor on the clitoris, and how do you make sure that it has a reliable waveform? And in our prototype, the device essentially has like an egg that you put inside of the vagina to kind of keep it in place. And then there's a very flexible kind of portion that goes forward, and you tuck under the labia in front of the clitoris. And it sounds crazy, like how would that work? But I personally tested the device and wore it and was incredibly impressed at how much I didn't feel it there, and how much it actually got a reliable reading, right? So what would a reliable reading be on this type of device? It would be that you would see a waveform that looks like pulsatile, right? Because everywhere in your body where you're measuring inward blood flow, right, from the arteries, you're going to want to see something that mirrors like your heartbeat, right? So it had that waveform, that pulsatile waveform, which means it was accurately collecting. And we studied it in a number of women who used it during, you know, a neutral video clip, right? And then during an erotic stimulus, and saw the change in the amount of blood flow in response to the erotic stimulus, right? So it was like, oh, neutral exposure, you know, the waveform is going, and then erotic stimulus, the waveform is a bunch higher, right? And that correlated to subjective arousal, which was like really cool because, again, we're actually measuring it, not just relying upon that reporting, right? So the very cool thing is that this type of technology has been used in sexuality studies before in a lab setting, right? But not with a wearable device that you can have at home, right? So you have, and the technical term is a photoplethysmography. I wish I could say that better. And so there are you know, research studies looking at this type of recording. But again, you have people going into, you know, sexuality research laboratories and having a device attached to them that has a bunch of like wires and cords and all this stuff, right? And ultimately, there's limitations in that, right? Because one, it's only going to obviously be used for research and not for people for home use, for self, you know, awareness, for biofeedback, for medication adjustment, right? So it's only going to be for research. And also, obviously, it's like the conundrum of how accurate can you measure anything about sexuality when somebody's like sitting attached to a bunch of cords in a research lab, right? So obviously, you can do really important work that way, but it's ultimately not going to be, you know, the same as the home environment. So that is the very long response to your question.
That is amazing.
it's like so cool. I love this stuff. It is so cool, right? And it's like people are like, why would you do that? And I'm like, well, I'm sure somebody once said, why would you put a Fitbit on? Like, why would you need to measure your heart rate, right? Like, and then we realized there's so much about understanding our bodies that can happen when we're able to have more insight, right? And why is it that our genitals and our sexual organs should not be part of that, right? Like, we always treat that part of our body like it's kind of this mystery and it's not sexy if we demystify it or something. And, you know, I my whole like life's mission is to say that's kind of nonsense. And it's sexy and we understand it and quantify it. And that's fine. Like, those two things live together and enhance each other, you know? So, yeah.
This is a weird thing to say to anybody other than you, but I am a kind of a urology fangirl. My son has an incredibly rare urological condition. So we grew up with him at the urologist. I used to do healthcare consulting, and urology was my favorite discipline to consult with. I have a friend who's doing her urogenital surgical residency right now. Hi, Rainey. I love you. And
she's great.
I understand why this is so important.
Yeah.
I think the average person doesn't necessarily understand how thinking about clitoral blood flow and how better understanding of arousal is going to impact their health. Like, how does this information change their lives?
There's a bunch of different ways you can approach that specifically. So the most basic way would be to say, okay, I'm going to pop this device in and just wear it overnight and measure my what's called nocturnal clitoral tumescence, okay? And that's basically your nighttime erections, right? So the penis has erectile chambers filled with blood, and that happens in response to sexual arousal. It also happens during nighttime, during REM sleep, right? And the same exact thing is the case for the erectile tissue in the clitoris, right? So in response to sexual stimulation or during certain phases of sleep, the erectile tissue in the clitoris engorges with blood, right? And again, same thing, right? So we know for a fact that loss of erections, particularly nocturnal erections, right, in a penis, are an early warning sign of health risk factors, okay? So we know for a fact that, and I'm not talking about what we call psychogenic erectile dysfunction, like, you know, 18-year-old who's very healthy, gets nervous and loses their erection, right? Like, that's very clear. I'm talking about, you know, somebody who's losing erections, again, you know, they're not waking up with a morning erection, what we call really a physiologic loss of erections, right? So that's a marker of overall health, right? And it's what we call like the canary in the coal mine for your cardiovascular health. And we know for a fact that that loss of erections predates other manifestations of cardiovascular disease by a number of years, meaning like that loss of erection will happen several years before a heart attack, a stroke, a transient ischemic attack, which is, you know, transient stroke. So it's like a huge deal. And why is that, right? It's because erections are a blood flow event, and the blood vessels, those arteries in the erectile tissue, are smaller than the blood vessels elsewhere in the body, right? So it's actually this amazing window into your health. Right? Like, and so we know that so much so that there was this consensus statement put out over 10 years ago, Princeton consensus statement. And it was basically saying that you should actually screen for erectile dysfunction in all men because it is a marker for cardiovascular disease, right? So like, typically we just say, oh, check your blood pressure, check your cholesterol, and you know, maybe that's what you have to do and ask, you know, about other risk factors. But actually, part of preventative health for all people should be asking about erectile dysfunction, which is like not really done, but it should be because it's a very powerful tool. So what am I all talking about? The penis and erectile dysfunctions and all this stuff. Well, the point being that we know for a fact that the clitoris works with the same mechanism, and loss of nocturnal clitoral tumescence, right? Loss of nighttime clitoral erections can be an early marker for cardiovascular disease. Up until now, we've had no way of, you know, clitoris having people to really report that, right? Because you're not like, hey, do you wake up with morning clitoral wood? Like, no, right? Like, it's not as observable. Right? So this is kind of the window into your health from the standpoint of actually being able to see, are you getting that response? Right? It's also an interesting way of looking at the effects of certain chronic diseases. For example, if you have diabetes and you're having a hard time keeping your blood sugar under control, right? One of the main things that can happen is erectile dysfunction, orgasmic dysfunction, reduced sensation of the penis, reduced ability to climax due to injury to the nerves. And exactly the same is the case, again, for females, right? So if somebody could say, I have diabetes, am I having those manifestations of damage to the nerves associated with my diabetes, right? And it doesn't have to be tingling in your fingers and your toes, right? What we call it, peripheral neuropathy. It doesn't have to be that you have to buy those special diabetic shoes. It doesn't have to be that you're having vision problems or needing dialysis, right? Like, it could be manifest in your sexual function, and that's something you could actually observe, right? and use that to really hone in on, the effect of a chronic disease on your body. So, that's one way. And then the other way is a much more dynamic way. So if somebody's coming in who is saying, hey, I'm having a problem, let's say, having an orgasm, right? This is a way you could potentially, something you could use at home for a type of biofeedback, right? Like, okay, this type of stimulus is really amping up my genital engorgement, right? Like, this type of port is amping up my genital engorgement. This type, not as much, right? And again, people say, oh, kind of, don't you just know it makes you horny? But it's so much more multifactorial than that, And so, having this ability to get that real-time feedback is very cool. And then the third thing would be, we know for a fact that changes in sleep, changes in medications, things like drinking alcohol can affect sexual function and performance. And so, this would be a way to say, okay, I changed my antidepressant medication. I'm not feeling aroused, right? Like, if I changed to a different one or I lowered my dose, right? Are my genitals having that responsiveness that I want them to have? So I'm sure there's a gazillion more potential ways you could use it. We're just kind of scheming in our minds at this point. But, it's the sort of thing where we're not even going to know all of the possibilities until people start getting out there and monitoring this stuff and looking at it and playing around with it. And, we kind of say like biohacking themselves.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought up biohacking. Hacking in general, the entire like sphere that goes back to, in many ways, William Gibson. And William Gibson has this quote that says, the street finds its own use for technology.
Yes.
And I oftentimes think about that, right? Until enough technology is out there in people's hands, you don't really know what's going to come out of it.
Totally. Totally. I mean, I can't think offhand, in my practice as a urologist all the time, I'll have a patient come in and say, oh, XYZ that you recommended, I used it in this way. Have you had any other patients do that? Because it was great. I'll be like, oh no, I didn't, that's cool. I'll mention that to someone else. And I really do think that will be the case. That will be the case with this kind of next generation of, what we call underwearable devices.
One of the things I was wondering about that is when you're talking about how it's hard for people to subjectively report, I am completely there with you. One of the things that I do for feedback cycles and everything is I have a meditation app, and the meditation app watches certain patterns of my pulse, my brain waves and everything, and then gives me audio feedback and helps me really get into the zone.
Yeah.
Which has been huge. Now, I don't know if I become a good meditator or I become good at tricking the app. That's the one part I don't know, but it's been good to have that feedback. So
yeah.
I was wondering, from the pleasure perspective, right? Maybe not necessarily the medical side. I love what you're saying about early warning signs and good feedback, yeah, and good health. We need to have that consistent level of needs met at that point before we can move forward. But from the pleasure side, can you tell me a little bit more about how that might guide someone in sort of getting in touch with their body?
There is something, and this is a point I have to mention, in our current form factor of this device, it would be difficult to do direct clitoral stimulation while wearing the device, right? So you can measure your arousal, like if you're not touching your genitals, right? And you're watching a porn, you're going to see that change in clitoral arousal, right? So the ultimate form factor would be to have it this way as just a sensor, but then also have options that are incorporated, let's say, into a sex toy, right? Like a vibrator. So that you can, not just as like, oh, nocturnal clitoral tumescence, not just documentation in that regard, but exactly that, like, you know, what during this kind of iterative process, right? So I think there are a lot of different ways. One, again, you could say like, right, incorporate with a vibrator, have different modes and, you know, potentially even have something that's responsive to what's causing increased in your, you know, increase in your genital engorgement, right? So like maybe the device says, oh, I see that the clitoral pulse amplitude really, really is enhanced with this vibration mode, right? And it goes to that, right? Or it hones in on that, you know? So there's potential to make it specifically geared towards optimizing that arousal without you having to just kind of like guess, right? But yeah, I think there's also definitely this role, even similar to what you're talking about with your meditation app, where you know, there's a like a cognitive component. Maybe you're watching porn and you have it hooked up to your clitoris and you record like a phenomenal waveform and you can save that category and be like, oh, this is like what got me going, you know? I don't know, right? Like, and of course it can also be used, like you could also use this during partnered sexual activity. I don't know. I mean, the sky's the limit. I have to like think about the best versions of that. As a urologist, I always think of sexual problems and less optimization of pleasure. So
I kind of have visions now of people in bringing this into their BDSM scenes.
Yes.
Into the whole, you know, we're going to really experiment with what kind of sensations turn us on. And maybe I think I don't like the feel of, I don't know, a single tail whip, but the device says otherwise. Or maybe a dominant could use that to track their submissive's arousal cycles over the course of a day and use that to like plan out scenes. It feels like one of those sort of quantified life sort of situations that with the right creative mind, you could do a lot of different creative things with that data.
And I love what you're saying in that kind of BDSM capacity, right? Like there's definitely such a, you know, space within eroticism where people like the idea of their body kind of betraying them, right? Like, right, where somebody who's the submissive is like, right, like, ow, ow, or oh no, or meek, but then their body's like having that engorgement and demonstrating that. And so I like that idea of somebody being able to say like, oh, there's this window into the soul of my genitals that I'm like, you know, kind of trying to emotionally not show, obviously, you know, amongst consenting adults, of course. But yeah, I mean, I think that's like very cool. that is super cool and definitely more creative of a thought than I ever had. So
Wolf and I first encountered FirmTech at a conference last year, an expo mm-hmm. last year. And that is one that, from what I understand, a man can use during partnered sex, but with this device, you really can't. What are sort of ideas for iterations, or what's the next evolution of this device so that it can be used for women or for at least clitoris havers the way it is for people with penises?
Yeah, that's an amazing question. I mean, you know, ultimately the difficulty is that, you know, the penis just has more real estate, right? So when you're talking about wearable devices, it's easier to figure out a way to have something that's on the penis, that's taking measurements, but also giving you you know, the surface area to be unencumbered in your sexual content, right? Contact, right? Like in with the firm tech device, it's the ring, it's a cock ring, it's at the base of your penis. And obviously you can still engage in penetrative activities while you have a cock ring on. So, you know, the challenge, of course, that we have right now, again, is that, you know, a sensor sitting in front of, right in front of the clitoral glands, right, the head of the clitoris, you know, is not that, and that also has an intravaginal component, not that, of course, you can engage in other types of erotic touching, but of course, there's going to be some difficulty having a, you know, a vaginal kind of egg, right, that secures the device in place, and this kind of component that extends towards the front and sits in front of the clitoral glands. Now, you know, again, when that is incorporated into something like a vibrator, certainly, again, you can use that during partnered sexual activity or solo sexual activity. I think, you know, perhaps the engineering challenge down the line would be to figure out a way to capture and record blood flow into the clitoral erectile tissue that's not just the clitoral glands, right? Because as, you know, I'm sure your educated listeners know, right? The clitoris is kind of like a wishbone shape. It's not just the tip. And it extends down actually deeper into the pelvis and, you know, kind of along the sides of the vagina. So, you know, potentially there's some way that we could figure out, you know, another way of recording that well. It's just difficult because you also have engorgement of the labia, there's engorgement, increased blood flow into the vaginal walls. And so there's, and we do find that based on the research that exists, that different areas of engorgement, like vaginal engorgement, are less correlated with, you know, climax, reaching orgasm than the clitoral blood flow itself, right? So like we know that the most sensitive one is looking at the clitoral blood flow rather than just like the vaginal blood flow. And we don't want to accidentally capture that. So it's a really amazing like engineering question, right? I mean, it's amazing that this is an engineering question at all. That's why I love doing this stuff. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, that would be like the ultimate goal. I'm just like thinking out loud now about it all.
On the engineering side, can you tell us a little bit about how it works, right? So we've got this device with lots of sensors. You already talked about the physicality of that. How does that data get to, you know, your firm for analysis? How does it get back to the person? Is it shareable?
Right. As I mentioned before, the technology behind it is photoplethysmography, which is really common. It's like a long word, but it's really common whenever, you know, you maybe go to the hospital and they put that pulse ox on you, you know, the little device that goes on your fingertip and has a little like red light, right? And it measures your heart rate and your oxygenation. So that's the same technology, and it's in a lot of wearable devices. And it's basically a little sensor where it shoots a little beam of light at your tissue, and based on the light that's reflected back, can tell the amount of blood that's flowing, right? And so that's how the thing works. And again, very common type of sensor. I'd say really that the innovation overall is figuring out a way to get that to sit on top of the clitoris, right? Like that is the, and to care about this, right? To fund it and do the research studies, because that is the other main domain that hasn't really been achieved until what we've been doing. So yeah, I mean, in the current, you know, form factor that we have, which is a prototype, you know, the data has been recorded into the device, and then you know, you actually have to like manually upload it and everything. But that's not difficult to, you know, once we have the commercial product. That's not a difficult thing to get over with our cock ring device. You know, there's an app and you can, you know, with Bluetooth connectivity, upload the information into your phone. And you basically have an app that shows you, you know, logs your data. When did you use it? How long were your erections? How hard were your erections? You know, we kind of made a erectile hardness score for based on your recordings. And then, you know, I don't know at this point if you're able to share it, but, you know, I don't see why you couldn't. I mean, that's not a big deal. Yeah.
Once the information's gathered and stored, between like choosing to share it or having other people access it, like how secure is the information when it's gathered by the device and stored?
You know, our team has access to the data. You know, we've analyzed it collectively for things like safety purposes. You know, so making sure, for example, like up until our device, you know, usually you tell people don't fall asleep with a cock ring on because there's a concern that it could decrease blood flow, right? And I'm sure you guys have heard horror stories. As a urologist, I have seen the horror stories of people who come into the emergency room and, you know, literally their penis looks like it's about to fall off and you have to call the fire department. And, you know, so one of the things we've done, you know, is to aggregate the data and just look at it from a safety standpoint, because we know people are sleeping with this thing on, and say, okay, this person has it on for an average of 8 hours and we see their nocturnal erection. So we know there's blood flow in and out of the penis, which means it's safe, right? So that's a way we'd aggregate the data. And, you know, that is, of course, de-identified. You know, in terms of like the ultimate goal with that data, you know, an important thing with all of these devices is to, you know, be cognizant of where ultimately your data will go and how it's used. Yeah.
It does make me wonder, you know, oftentimes security is proportional to the size of the company.
Yeah.
Do you guys have a data privacy officer, a security officer? I couldn't necessarily tell from the website.
Yeah. We have our primary, engineer who does all the data management. And, you know, I would have to have him talk to that specifically, but yeah, I can't give you like the exact details about how the data is stored, but excellent question.
So I have kind of an odd question. We've been talking about, you know, vaginas and clitorises and blood flow and engorgement and arousal. And this is obviously a product that you want more people to know about and hear about. And yet all of these are terms that will get us instantly banned in our advertising on social media. How are you as a company, you as a spokesperson, how are you guys navigating the conversations around sexual health and sex tech in a way that makes it accessible for people without ending up in the social media void?
I wish I had a good answer to that. It's so hard. this is one of the things that absolutely kills me about social media. Yeah, I mean, if you say sexual health, you know, you can get censored. You can be told you can't run an ad. I mean, I've had so many problems with this. You know, I had previously been working at this digital women's sexual health clinic. And we really, really wanted to be focused on sexual health. And you can't, it's so hard to advertise for that. And so people are like, well, just call it women's health. And I'm like, that can mean so many other things. And that frustrates me, because you don't liberate sexual health. You don't normalize talking about sexual health if you put it behind so many layers of vagaries, you know, like these are body parts, and the use of these body parts are fundamental to human wellness. And it's not anything to be ashamed of. And it's not any like, right. A board certified physician saying the word clitoris and sex shouldn't be like so crazy, right? Like, I mean, it's just, these are body parts, right? I mean, I tell my daughter's less than a year old and I'm like, you know, I tell my husband, okay, if we're going to put Desitin on her, we say vulva. You don't say down there, you know, like it's not, it's just body parts. And so I go crazy about this stuff. So I wish I had a good answer to that. And it's a huge barrier. And I think we just have to keep normalizing discussions of these things and yeah, kind of demanding that social media does a better job at differentiating, you know, explicit content versus medical content related to sexual health. Right. And I feel like with this generation of AI and everything, like they should be able to develop more sophisticated content filters. You know, like if you're in the grocery store and you're scrolling through your phone, I could understand why you don't want to see, right, like a pornographic scene on your social media, but you know, seeing somebody say like, "Hey, learn about the clitoris," you know, webinar, right? So vastly different. And I will say another thing. This is just like a related topic that when you speak about, you know, kind of sex being censored and sexual health being censored. You know, with these new AI enabled image generators, right? Like I think, what are some of the main ones? Like the DALL-E and I don't know. There's a whole bunch of them, right? Yeah. And if you ask them to try to draw you a diagram of the lungs, right? It will do it. And if you ask it to try to draw you a diagram of the clitoris, it won't do it because it says it violates its content policy. And even if you explicitly type in like, please draw a diagram of an anatomic diagram of the clitoris for educational purposes, it's like, that's dirty, you know? And it's like, we cannot codify into this kind of next generation of, you know, the technical revolution or whatever everybody wants to call AI. We cannot codify this prudishness into it because if we will, we're going to fall behind the ball in our understanding of how that region of our body works, right? And it's like a huge point of advocacy that people care about the intersectionality of technology and sex. Like this is stuff we have to advocate for. And I don't know the best way forward, but I'd love your guys' thoughts on this.
I mean, the intersectionality of technology and sexuality is kind of our whole jam. And I think that the more we explore it and unpack it and poke in the corners, the more we find surprising barriers or unexpected resistance, even from people that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily expect it, or places or companies or tools like DALL-E.
Yeah.
It's definitely an ongoing conversation. As we move towards wrapping up, I have one more question for you because, you know, I am a sex therapist and you are a urologist and I love moments like this. I would like you to speak to the medical necessity and health benefits of pleasure, please. Tell people why their right to pleasure is a healthcare issue.
We know for a fact that, you know, physical intimacy improves, I mean, it improves depression, it improves, you know, like joy in life. Obviously, sexual activity is, I mean, that's cardiovascular exercise, right? I mean, like, there's just the very basic point of like, increasing your heart rate is good for you. You know, the neurochemicals that are released in your brain are very positive. There's tons of scientific data to support the fact that having intimacy and pleasure is a positive thing. Not only is pleasure good for you, but intentionally denying yourself pleasure has no scientific evidence. And that's something that I also feel very strongly that it's like important to talk about on the flip side of that coin.
I love it. That's a really thorough, passionate answer.
Well, and on that note, I feel like we've got to deny ourselves the pleasure of continuing the conversation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we are coming up on time. Ashley, thanks so much for joining us today and explaining this new innovation you and your firm are working on.
Well, thank you for having me.
And thank you for tuning in to Securing Sexuality, your source of the information you need to protect yourself and your relationships.
Securing Sexuality is brought to you by the Bound Together Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit. From the bedroom to the cloud, we're here to help you navigate what safe sex looks like in a digital age.
Be sure to check out our website, securingsexuality.com, for links to more information about the topics we discussed here today, as well as our live events.
And join us again for more fascinating conversations about the intersection of sexuality and technology. Have a great week.